Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, new federal rules have one family planning clinic in the state leaving a grant program.
It really doesn't serve our patients well to not be able to provide complete medical care.
In a new installment of our Belonging series, two young people talk about how the love and support of their tribal communities pulls them to stay in Wyoming.
My culture makes me feel secure, safe, strong, connected. I feel that I know myself better.
Plus, stories on the BLM move out west and an interview with Western author Craig Johnson.
Also in the next hour, we will urge you to support this award-winning program with your pledge of support. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome back to Open Spaces with Bob Beck. I'm Maggie Mullen. Title 10 is a federal program that's geared towards helping low-income or uninsured people receive family planning and reproductive health care, though new regulations have some clinics rethinking their participation in the program. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on how the changes to Title 10 will affect the state's clinics.
Hi, I'm here to see the director.
Okay. Gillette Reproductive Health is like any other doctor's office. There are people waiting, a TV is playing, and there are stacks of magazines. But this clinic is a Title 10 clinic. Julie Price is its executive director. She says Title 10 clinics provide reproductive health care for low-income and uninsured people, but people with insurance can also go there. Price says these clinics provide services like HIV testing.
The services that people come in for are well woman exams or STD testing and treatment or clinical breast exams or mammograms or whether maybe they want to see if they're pregnant. We will do a lot of the contraceptive care. So what we say is we can teach you how to get pregnant or how not to get pregnant.
There are 11 Title 10 clinics in Wyoming, and they're all under the umbrella of the Wyoming Health Council. The nonprofit is responsible for distributing the Title 10 funds to clinics around the state. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services handed down new regulations that Title 10 clinics have to follow if they want to keep their grant funding. Rob Johnston is the Wyoming Health Council's executive director. He says the new rules limit what staff can say to clients who might be looking for an abortion.
In most of our clinics, we have had RNs or others providing these kinds of services. And now that type of conversation is being restricted to licensed professionals such as physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, what have you.
It's worth mentioning, Title 10 funds have never paid for abortions. They can just provide information for women on the next steps of pregnancy. But with the new rule, only a doctor, physician's assistant, or nurse practitioner can be the one to give pregnant women a list of options for any sort of further health care. The list could include an abortion provider. It just can't be acknowledged as such. Johnston says that's problematic in Wyoming, where those people are only in the office a couple of times a week.
It's really restricting sometimes what can happen on those other 3 days. And it may mean that people have to make appointments months in advance, you know, which could complicate, you know, what their needs are.
He says by certain staff not being able to directly help with referrals, it adds extra hoops pregnant women have to jump through to look for the right provider for them. Because of all this, the Kaiser Family Foundation says more than 900 family planning or reproductive health clinics have left the Title 10 program, including one in our state.
We made the decision along with our advisory council and with staff that it really doesn't serve our patients well to not be able to provide complete medical care.
That's Jody Pond, the Director of Health for the Teton County Health Department. She says of the $38,000 the clinic received from the program, it would have to spend about $8,000 of it hiring someone to help with the paperwork and data they are required to provide in the program.
It's also been very unstable for the last few years, where it should have been a 3-year grant and we've had to write a grant application every 6 months.
Pond says in their county, she's confident they'll raise the money to continue their program. She says they have committed to continuing all of the clinic's services and acknowledges that Teton County's clinic is in a different position than other clinics in the state.
We have the support of our county health department and the infrastructure here. And again, a lot of Title X clinics are standalone, and so they have rent to pay and lights to turn on, and so they don't have the, I guess I'd say, luxury to be able to say, you know, we can't do this because of this regulation.
Rob Johnston with the Wyoming Health Council says clinics in other counties may face challenges.
If they want to continue to provide these services, to be honest, they're not in a financial position to be able to find other funding for those services or to reach the clients that have been historically served by them.
And in talking to other clinics around the state, they say they haven't even thought about leaving because Title X is the cornerstone of their budget. Johnston says now his focus is on making sure the remaining clinics are in compliance with the new rules while also maintaining the same services. He says part of the changes to Title X also includes separating family planning clinics from other kinds of health providers, especially if those clinics are associated with local public health departments.
They're talking about physical location within a building. They're talking about whether or not you have shared electronic health records, whether you have a shared billing system, those kinds of things. And for many of our clinics, they do. Now, that would not be the case in some of our standalone. But in those that are co-located with public health, it could become an issue.
Johnston says his organization has to submit its action plan on how to do that by March 2020. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
The Bureau of Land Management is moving more staff, and perhaps more significantly, its headquarters to the Mountain West. Depending on who you talk to, this will either make the BLM more efficient or give preferential treatment to the fossil fuel industry. Noah Glick reports.
Grand Junction, Colorado is where the BLM is setting up its new base. The mid-sized town of about 63,000 people is named for the meeting spot of the mighty Colorado and Gunnison Rivers. A city tourism video puts
Grand
it like this.
Is where the Rocky Mountains give way to the natural beauty of the Southwest, and the differences are dramatic. There's nowhere else like it.
By the end of next year, 27 BLM staffers should move from Washington, D.C. to this idyllic town halfway between Denver and Salt Lake City, and hundreds more will be scattered across the West. Grand Junction Mayor Rick Taggart says the shakeup will give his city a stronger political voice.
As a smaller city in western Colorado, we're not as well known. And because of that, sometimes we don't have the voice even in our state government that we'd like to have.
But it's not just local community and leadership voices in our region that are set to be amplified. Jeremy Gelman is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he studies congressional partisanship and agenda setting. He says industry also stands to benefit.
So in the case of BLM, mining interests, logging companies, farmers, ranchers, their locus of power, their sort of epicenter of where most of their people are is out west. And Republicans want those folks easy access to BLM when regulations are being written.
And some of those folks will be close, very close. The Grand Junction headquarters will be in the same building as a corporate office for Chevron, a state oil and gas association, and Laramie Energy, an oil and gas producer. In a statement, a BLM spokesperson said any suggestion that the location was chosen to give select special interest groups unethical access is flagrant and ironic. Gelman says it's hard to know the intentions behind the decision, but overall, he says there's no doubt the move will make it easier for industry interests to access BLM bureaucrats, and harder for national environmental groups who employ lobbyists in Washington.
For really big stuff, you're going to expect all the big players to show up. But for the smaller day-to-day stuff, who you're hearing from, what's important, what's not important, that sort of access does matter. It's not everything, but it does sort of tilt the playing field a little bit to who can talk to those bureaucrats and who can get that face-to-face time.
That's a selling point for Utah Congressman Rob Bishop. He's the ranking Republican on the House Natural Resources Committee. He says moving the BLM out west will put agents closer to the lands they manage and the interests of those lands.
Having people on the ground who have the ability of making the final decision, not just having a job there locally, but also having the ability of making those decisions, that's going to be a net plus. That's going to benefit people.
Though not everyone, it seems, will benefit. Many BLM employees have expressed frustration over the move, and the investigative nonprofit ProPublica reported that since mid-July, 11 BLM employees have already quit, with more resignations expected to come. That has some Democrats and environmental groups worried, saying that losing these seasoned staffers could further strengthen the influence of the oil and gas industry. But Bishop doesn't buy that.
Why could simply the gas and oil industry have more influence than, say, an environmental group that's out there or a cattle ranger that's out there? I mean, I'm sorry, that's an argument that you come up with to try and find some reason to stop a logical move from going forward. There is no merit to that.
The rationale for it is hard to figure out. In fact, I don't think there is one.
That's House Natural Resources Committee Chairman Raul Grijalva, a Democrat.
Given the track record of this administration, particularly the Department of Interior, that seem to be whole bet on making sure that gas and oil are taken care of and the fossil fuel industry is taken care of above anything else.
Grijalva says his committee has not been given enough information on the types of jobs moving west, and he's concerned about decision-making positions being so far away from Congress.
The last thing you want is little fiefdoms in each state making their own decisions and doing their own procedures. And I think that's part of the intention, to allow a state that is all for extraction and nothing else to have the freedom to do that without any oversight by the federal government to the law and to other requirements.
Grijalva says he's prepared to issue subpoenas if the committee doesn't get the information it's looking for. The House and Senate have both refused to provide funding for the move in the latest budget, but a Department of Interior spokesperson says the relocation is moving forward using funding previously approved by Congress. The BLM could be in its new home by the end of next year. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
When we come back, we'll hear about how one group is reenacting African Americans' history in the West. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen. African American history in the American West goes back hundreds of years, but not a lot of that history made it into the history books, and many stories are at risk of getting lost in time. A museum in Denver is working to salvage them before that happens. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with the Black American West Museum's Reenactor Guild when they came to Laramie's Higher Ground Fair. She asked about the characters they portrayed in costume on stage at the fair.
My name is Elise Clark. I play the character Mary Fields. Mary Fields was born a slave around 1832. She came out west to take care of her friend. She carried mail. She had a restaurant. She had a laundry business. And she had a running bet she could knock anyone out.
Hello, my name is Steve Shepherd, and I play Barney Lancelot Ford. And Barney Lancelot Ford was an escaped slave.
When I got to Colorado, I couldn't find a place to stay. They wouldn't lease me a room or anything, so I stayed in Aunt Clara Brown's woodshed overnight. I couldn't buy a gold mine because I was a former slave. Actually, I was an escaped slave. And at that time, there was a law called the Fugitive Slave Law. So if they found me, I was going right back to Georgia or back to Virginia, where I came from as a slave.
I owned two very luxurious hotels, one in Denver and one in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Oh, my name is John Thomas, and I actually do two different characters. The first is Oliver Toussaint. That's why he was called O.T. Jackson. But O.T. was a very shrewd business person. He was a very progressive person, and around the country there was a big effort to establish colored communities. O.T. wanted to do the same thing in Colorado, and the Negro Business League didn't back him on it, so he did it. He said, to hell with you guys, I'll do it on my own, and he did. Five families started it in 1910. By 1920, there were about 700 inhabitants, and the net value of the property was close to $1 million. The other character I portray is Tuskegee Airmen. In 1972, there were 19 designated original Tuskegee Airmen in Colorado. And today there are three remaining. The rest have died. This jacket belonged to one of the original airmen, yes. But I interviewed three of the pilots and for about 2 hours each, and I put together about a 30-minute presentation.
Hi, my name is Linda Brooks Brown, and I play the character of Aunt Clara Brown.
How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. My name is Aunt Clara Brown. I was born in Spotsylvania, Virginia, sometime in the 1800s. You know, at that time, enslaved people didn't have birthdays.
When she got here to Denver, she established a business. Whenever anyone wanted to come that came here, she opened her house, and she also gave money. It was $10,000 that she had saved with hard work, and she used that $10,000 to help people after emancipation to come here to Colorado to establish a new life here.
My name is Alton Clark, and I portray Lewis Price, a entrepreneur during the 1800s. He was sold to another plantation, and he escaped. He borrowed a wagon and some horses and was going across country from Kansas to Denver City and Cheyenne, and did that for several years until he amassed enough money to move out to Cheyenne, Wyoming, where he established a laundry business. He moved from Wyoming to Denver City at the time and established himself another laundry business where he amassed enough money to buy his first piece of property. He was known as the Black Wizard because of his powerlessness in the business world and selling properties. And for grins and giggles, he would travel up and down Colfax Avenue with his white driver, his white horses, and his white carriage, him and his wife. So.
Sounds like a real character.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us the money, man.
My name is Felicia Foster. I play Hattie McDaniels. And Hattie McDaniels, she was a great performer. She basically had two roles, which one was in film and one was in television. And she also had a great radio career. She came to Denver with her basically large family. What I also noticed is that she went to one of the old East High School, which I did a lot of research on because Denver was a lot different before when she came to Denver. So when she got here, she kind of built herself up. She had a long singing and basically dancing career. And from what I figured out, when she left East High School, she got George Morris's Traveling Orchestra, which was a very large Black touring group, and they called themselves the Melody Makers. She moved to Hollywood, California, and that's where she began her career in film. She had a lot of stars that supported her, like Clark Gable, James Cagney, because she starred alongside them, and they did ask those questions, why wasn't she getting more than supporting roles? So when she finally got Gone with the Wind and she won that Best Actress Award, the introducer, she basically said that, you know, she made people think about what, you know, television and film was.
Because Black history is lost, it is not mainstream history. There are many more characters, but the record is not there. So there's a lot of piecework that goes into developing these characters. You have to look in various places to find the information. It's not readily available.
Now, from my standpoint, it was a matter of just becoming so familiar with that when I get on stage, it's almost like I'm telling my story. And that's how I approach it.
Are you an actor outside of this?
No. In fact, I was in the construction business. That was my career.
So how'd you end up?
I've always been a ham. No.
It takes a lot of scratching and itching to get to what most of our characters have been, you know, like the Black Cowboys. I had an uncle that died in a stampede that he was a cowboy.
It's family history too.
It's family history too, because my father and my mother were revolutionists. You know, because they told me not to take any stuff from the man. You know,
that's what you grew up with.
That's what I grew up with. Right. And so
people of African descent have been here for over 600 years in the West, which is not always known. When Columbus came, there were people of African descent that came with him. A lot of those people stayed. So when we look at the Western history, I think it was easier to come west sometimes than it was to get north. Out west, it wasn't civilized. A lot of these laws that we're talking about, even for Barney and did not come west till civilization came west.
You know, black folks had come to the west. If they were escaped slaves, they knew they were free. Barney Ford in 1863 went to the bank and they loaned him $9,000. Now, if he tried that after the Jim Crow movement, it wouldn't have happened. So you see, there was a great influx of different types of folks after emancipation. And it's been kind of like up and down as far as race relations.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with the Black American West Museum's cast of history reenactors. You can see videos of their performances at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
When we come back, we have the next episode of our Belonging series as we hear from two students from the Wind River Reservation and a discussion about research regarding the weather in Yellowstone. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. With Bob Beck, I'm Maggie Mullen. Around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave the state each year. So Wyoming Public Radio has turned the microphone over to young people to talk about what's behind their decisions to stay or go. Gabby St. Clair and Angelo Sage both went to high school in predominantly white towns bordering the Wind River Reservation. Now, they say the love and support of their tribal communities helps them succeed at Central Wyoming College and pulls them to stay here in Wyoming.
As of right now, honestly, Wyoming kind of feels just like a home to me. I guess it's just through ancestry. You kind of just feel like you belong here. Your people, you know, thrived here. It's our reservation. And so I honestly don't know what's your perspective on that. Like,
my take on that is my specific belief on why I don't want to leave Wyoming is because back on the Arapaho side, on the Wind River side anyways, that's where my home is. I want to give back to the community. I want to start a small business. This is my home. I'd rather not be anywhere else. Everywhere else is kind of like overrated.
So you went to Riverton. That's my rivalry high school. Mm-hmm. So I really don't like Riverton. Just kidding. But both schools are predominantly white. Mm-hmm. How was Riverton with that?
So before I came to Riverton, I was actually on the reservation at Arapaho School. Once I got into middle school, I was in Riverton all the way up to high school. Now, I faced adversity along the way, but I had a good time, and it also helped build my character as well, because I also was a little bit insecure about myself, but I overcame all these odds, and I'm better with myself and more content with myself now. So how was on the opposite end in Lander, how was the rivalry taken down there? Because here in Riverton, some people got really stoked about, but for me, I really didn't care.
I mean, as an athlete, that's like one of the main things we strive for, is to beat Riverton in the dirt. But it actually brings me to a great point, that a lot of the racism I experienced was in sports. And it's just like you gotta, when people actually try to call you something, try to get at you negative, and just because of the way you are, just because of the race or the people you hung out with or your ways, man, it's just like it kind of just bounced off, like, as an athlete. But during school, I never really had a problem. I mean, everyone was pretty nice, and it's like kind of like we were not really the superheroes, but, you know, kind of like everyone knew the natives because of the way we played sports, the way we were. And as giving people, people saw that because when we had senior nights, they noticed that all the natives usually gave out gifts to everyone, not just the coaches, but their whole team. And so I think throughout the years, I guess it's just kind of evolved to like more diversity in Lander, and I really like that.
I wish I could say the same about Riverton. Jokes. Riverton wasn't too bad. There was occasional racism there, but it's all just a matter of like that they were taught that. They're ignorant to the fact that there's other people out there besides them. I feel a sense of belonging in my tribe because our ceremonies and a lot of our activities are community-based. When I help and sweat, it's an open thing where we express ourselves and talk about how we feel, and everyone gets an opportunity as well to do those positions from being a Hinan, Net Chinen, which means waterman in Arapaho. Even in like Sundance, we can help around with that, help our families. And shoot, even in powwows, you can help out with them, you can dance in them. My culture makes me feel secure, safe, strong, connected. I feel that I know myself better.
Man, I sure wish I could say that I culturally connect like that because, man, if I could go on the powwow trail, I would, but there's just not enough time. I'm kidding. But the sense of belonging I get is especially when we use our own language. And it's honestly kind of like sad, but it's also kind of like upbringing in a way because you want to keep your language. You want it to stay here. But it's like we're losing so many native speakers just day after day, and it's crazy. And it's like, I guess in that cultural perspective, I can see that. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, that's so cool that you're speaking Arapaho. I mean, I think that's so dope, man. You introduced yourself in Arapaho. I mean, I could have been Shoshone, but I mean, you know, it's just, I guess that's what makes me feel like a belonging, at least one of the points. It's really nice.
So growing up on the Wind River Reservation, what was the best part about growing up there, in your opinion?
Man, the scenery. I guess words can't explain it. You just gotta be part of it, you know what I mean? Like, you just gotta be part of the community in order to really experience how it is. And not many people get that. I mean, tourists come through, and I hate tourist season, trust me, but like, there's a heartbeat to Wind River that a lot of people don't know about. And I just love it. And it's a positive one. And it's just that sense of home, I guess. It's that nice feeling. I don't know if you get the same feeling. Do you?
Well, my favorite part about growing up on the reservation was just having that really good feeling of actually knowing that I have a lot of family. Having all the cousins, a bunch of grandmas is just the best feeling in the world. Makes me want to tear up because I'm thankful to have so many good artists and inspirational people in my life.
That's Angelo Sage and Gabby St. Clair for our series Belonging, where we ask young people to reflect on their place in Wyoming. This piece was produced by Savannah Marr, who is a Report for America Corps member.
What will the future forests of Yellowstone National Park look like? That's what Dr. Monica Turner of the University of Wisconsin-Madison is trying to figure out by creating models for possible ways the Yellowstone ecosystem could react to hotter and drier weather. Dr. Turner was awarded the Camp Monaco Prize to do just that. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska asks Dr. Turner how the model can project the future landscape of Yellowstone.
The model is actually the thing that's making the prediction for the future forest condition. Mm-hmm. And so the model is very detailed, and so we provided a lot of information about the growth and the death and the light requirements and the water requirements and the nutrient requirements for each of the tree species. We then use our own data to test whether or not the model can adequately grow trees and project them in the right places for the right species at the right sizes and the right heights. So we've been doing all of that for the past few years, and we're now at the point where it works very well. It matches the historical data very well, and we're now at the point of projecting forward.
And what type of scenarios are you projecting?
So we're projecting forward with three different general circulation models, and they all warm in temperature, so that's kind of a given. One of them is an increase in precipitation as well, so it's a hot but wetter scenario. The other two have drought conditions, and they differ in the duration and the intensity of droughts. So one has a longer, more prolonged drought, think Dust Bowl, kind of in mid-century, and the other one has more periodic droughts. So these conditions kind of span the possibilities of what we think could happen here, and precipitation patterns are the most uncertain in these models. And then there are two different scenarios for how the carbon emissions will change. So one is the higher level, and current rates are already surpassing that. So where that's reasonable if we don't change directions. 4.5 is lower carbon emissions, and that would be less heating of the climate. The key thing there is that these are not predictions of what will happen. They tell you what the consequences will be if something happens. So if this, then these things will be likely.
Some would say that this is a natural process of the Earth, that the Earth just naturally gets warmer. So the scenarios that you were just talking about, are some of them kind of more natural, would you say, and less human-caused?
So I would say that all of these scenarios have a very strong human component forcing the changes in the climate. So the climate has indeed changed over the past 10,000 years, and we know for this system that fires like the kind that we saw in 1988 have happened at intervals that vary between 100 and 300 years over the past 10,000 years. So during periods when the climate was warmer, fires happened more frequently, maybe every 100 years. When the climate was cooler, fires were maybe every 300 years. And so we have seen that variation. What's different now is both the rate at which the changes are happening. We're seeing changes that are so fast over decadal scales relative to century or millennial scales. And we are also anticipating, based on some of the earlier work from our group, that the weather conditions that we used to have very infrequently could be happening every 30 years, every 20 years, every 10 years, et cetera. So climate like we had in 1988 would become the norm, not the exception. And so that is outside the bounds of what has been reported for 10,000 years.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadalska speaking with Dr. Monica Turner about her research on how landscapes of Yellowstone may change in the future.
When we come back, we will wrap up the show by speaking with Western author Craig Johnson. Please support this high-quality program with your pledge. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen. Best-selling author Craig Johnson has just published his 15th book. It's called Land of Wolves. The book continues the adventures of Walt Longmire, a sheriff who solves mysteries in a fictional rural Wyoming county. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones spoke with Johnson about how he used to be a teacher before he turned to writing.
I just decided, okay, look, you can either continue teaching or you can really get serious about the writing. And, you know, I had this idea, which was the idea that was the plot for The Cold Dish, the first book in the Walt Longmire series. And I thought, okay, you're going to have to get really serious about this and sit down and devote all your attentions and energies, you know, to just writing that first book. And that's always the hardest one. I think if you talk with most writers, they would, you know, admit that, you know, the first book is always the most difficult, simply because you haven't done it before. You know, I mean, you're climbing a whole new mountain. For me, it took practically 10 years to get The Cold Dish, you know, to where it was that I wanted it to be. You get one shot at it, and I just wanted to make sure that shot was the best shot that I could possibly have.
And before The Cold Dish, did you already know that you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be a writer, but wanting to be a writer is kind of like wanting to be an astronaut in the sense that, you know, the odds are against you so badly, you might as well just keep it to yourself. Like then, and that way, if you don't get it done, then you're not embarrassing yourself publicly. Like, and it's kind of one of those situations. I thought I'll just wait before it is that I decide that I'm going to let anybody know. I thought, you know, maybe after it gets sold, then maybe I'll let people know I'm writing a book or something along those lines. Otherwise, you can run into trouble.
So tell me, during those 10 years that you were writing and kind of finessing The Cold Dish, Did you have readers, like people that gave you feedback?
Mostly my poor wife, like, who had to, you know, read all the different versions of that first novel. She's got a remarkable background in the, actually, that her parents were the editors of the Hartford Courant. She's very shrewd. Like, more than anything else, she knows me, and she knows the voice, you know, that Walt uses in telling the, you know, the books. And I think that that's, you know, something that continues today.
So over the time that you've been writing the 15 books in the Walt Longmire series, how has your writing changed and how have your interests in the story changed?
At least, you know, you're not reinventing the wheel, you know, when you write a series. Like, I mean, you do have the opportunity to have a recognizable environment and a recognizable ensemble of characters that people grow to love, like that, and want, you know, on a regular basis. And then the challenge kind of becomes doing something different, you know, making sure that you're not, you know, becoming stereotypical or cliched in your approach to the books, and that you're not, you know, just doing the same thing, you know, and stacking up bodies like cordwood. And I think a lot of that has to do with social issues. An awful lot of the time, I tend to approach, you know, the books, you know, with the idea that what I write is, you know, what I tend to refer to as, you know, socially responsible crime fiction, in the sense that, you know, I'm not looking to just, you know, stack up bodies, you know, along the way, that I'm going to try and do something a little bit different and maybe deal with contemporary social and political issues that, you know, that we as Westerners, and specifically, you know, Wyomingans, you know, have to contend with. The newest book, Land of Wolves, you know, deals a lot with racial prejudice, like it, and the workforce situations, you know, and the other is character development. I really enjoy, you know, having the characters develop. I mean, I would never want anyone to pick up one of the, you know, first Walt books and then pick up, you know, the 15th Walt book and think Walt hasn't changed in that amount of time. Like, I mean, the things that Walt comes in contact, you know, with in the realm of law enforcement, you know, especially with the spectrum, you know, that being a sheriff has, you know, I mean, we have counties here in Wyoming that are the size of Maryland, you know, and so with limited backup and limited resources, you know, these individuals are working with a broad spectrum of not only, you know, human activity, but crime as well. To have that kind of effect, you know, you're going to change. Things are going to happen to you over especially a period of, you know, almost, you know, 15 years.
15 books. That's prolific.
Everybody says that, but I keep looking back and thinking, well, you could have worked a little harder like that. But I don't know. I mean, I'm a big one for putting everything I've got, you know, into the Walt books, you know, and I have lots of opportunities, you know, to do other material with the TV show Longmire and with the novellas like that I produce, you know, on an infrequent basis, like it, and also the collections of short stories that are also concerning Walt. You know, it's I don't know. I guess it's a lot like that to put out, but I also am a little bit of that blue collar ethic of writing, in that, you know, I don't stare out windows and, you know, kind of wait, you know, for the motivation to strike, you know, the muse, you know, to take me. I mean, for me, it's a joy to write every day. I really enjoy it. Every once in a while, I'll hear all these writers that say, oh, it's so difficult, and it gives me headaches, and, you know, it's like, you know, basically going to the writing desk and opening up my veins and bleeding into the computer key. And all I'm thinking is, you're not doing it right. Something's wrong here, like that. I mean, I you know, for me, it's one of the great joys of my life, you know, to sit down at that keyboard and to, you know, to be able to write, to have that opportunity.
That was writer Craig Johnson speaking to Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones. He just released his 15th book, Land of Wolves.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show, you can find it and individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Please support Open Spaces and all of our Wyoming news with a pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.